Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest thrilling adventure from Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, Rockchick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are you this fine day?
Very good, thank you, Michael. Had a great day yesterday out with all the rock and rollers.
You're out gallivanting. Yes, tell us all about it, please.
So we have a biannual event called the Scribs, which is short for the Scribblers, Pluckers, Thumpers and Squawkers, which is basically rock writers, rock singers, drummers and guitarists.
Right.
And we convene twice a year at a big pub in Barnes in West London. Mm. And have lots of live music and, you know, a meal and all get together. And we were a little bit depleted yesterday. I think we were 39 or 40 people. We're usually about 50 altogether.
Okay.
But some people are, you know, laid up. They can't get in because of travel restrictions. Mm. There was the storm and all that yesterday
so on.
But, somebody said to me, it's a shame the ones who didn't make it. And I said, yes, but surely the event is about those who did make it.
Mm,
it's about those who came rather than those who didn't come.
I totally agree. Was your pal Noddy Holder there?
No, Noddy lives in the north, and Storm Barra was doing its thing yesterday.
Yeah, it was. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
One of our number came down from Glasgow the night before.
Glasgow!
Yeah, and he was on a train back home at 5 o'clock the next morning because he saw the storm coming and didn't want to get stuck.
Yeah, so. No, I don't blame him.
And then, of course, we got the COVID restrictions. Although one, Ray Williams, who was famously the guy who introduced Reg Dwight to the lyricist whose name has just gone out of my
head.
Bernie Taupin. Yep. Thank you very much.
Yep.
And created the enigma that is Elton John, Ray Williams. He flew in from North Carolina two days before.
Mm.
He got his COVID test done immediately. He got the certificate. He brought it to show us.
Mm.
So, you know, where there's a will, I always think.
Yeah.
If somebody's determined to be at something or to get somewhere, then they will do it.
Yeah, no,
hook or crook.
I totally agree. As we're speaking, because it's unfolding so fast, of course, Downing Street looks like they've got a bit of a problem with the party, don't they? You know,
they're stuffed, aren't they? They really are. Did you watch the footage?
Yeah, I've seen it all. Yeah, I've seen Allegra Stratton sitting there smiling, joking, all that kind of stuff.
Did she look drunk to you in that piece?
Maybe. She might have been intoxicated. Her attitude suggested that she was a bit carefree. I know what you mean, exactly. The sort of attitude was very strange, wasn't it?
Insouciant, I think, is the word.
Insouciant, great word. Yeah. Great word from the great wordsmith. Yes, I like it.
And she just kind of stood there, falling around over the lectern.
That's right.
And dissolving into giggles.
Yeah.
And looking very sort of important.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, whatever happened to Allegra Stratton?
Yeah.
Where is she now?
Well, believe it or not, she was still in charge of COP26, or still is, as we're recording. COP26 is still going on. I didn't realise that. But there are still people meeting, you know, about it in this country, and she's in charge of it. Anyway, look, it's not for us to say why.
I think, though, it's quite clear that they had a party.
Well, you know, even the Prime Minister in the Commons said all rules were, were complied with. He wasn't there. So that's his get out of card. You know what I mean? I don't think there are any elected politicians there from what I've, you know, read.
Do you know what I'm waiting for? I think even as we speak, there exists some bit of footage from somebody's mobile phone and somebody is in negotiations with a newspaper or a TV channel to sell that for the most amount of money they can possibly get out of it. And something will emerge that will say otherwise.
Yeah, well, look, you know, it's the nature of our business, isn't it, to find out things that people don't want. I remember my very first lesson in journalism when I was a trainee journalist. The guy who was the lecturer said newspapers are both things that people want to get information into and things that people want to keep information out of. And I thought that just about summed it up for the rest of my life. But anyway, there we are. I mean, meanwhile, Boris is going around looking like some sort of teddy bear with the word police written on his woolly hat and busting down doors to try and smash up the middle-class coke epidemic. I mean, we've had this one for years, haven't we?
Yeah, it's not going to go away, is it? The worst aspect of this you know, the drug crisis in this country,
yeah,
is all the innocent children who have been drawn into this County Lines,
yes,
scandal.
Absolutely.
A friend of mine has one of her sons is caught up in this, and yeah, it's ruined his life.
Yeah.
And this is about trafficking drugs into rural areas and small towns, mm, away from the major cities. And it's vulnerable kids whose lives are being destroyed by this.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, why is the emphasis, on these poor middle class rich people, mm, who've got enough money to pay for all this cocaine?
Yeah.
You know, fine, good on them. Do it if you want. Blow your head off. I don't care. But what about the children? I don't hear a lot of people talking about them.
Yeah, no, it's the hidden epidemic. I don't see it about, you see. Maybe I mix with the wrong people, but I never see people actually doing it. And, you know, you say that, people go off to the loo every 5 minutes and, you know, in restaurants, all that kind of stuff. Either I'm incredibly naive or it's not happening around me. I've never taken it myself, so I wouldn't know. But apparently, you know, it's so prevalent now that even the government have got to act on it, because it is the middle class scourge. Anyway, listen.
Well, it's in the House of Commons.
Yeah,
but I've had taxi drivers who've talked to me about their lives being destroyed because they became coke addicts. And you think, taxi drivers?
Yeah.
You know, this stuff is actually suddenly becoming too cheap if taxi drivers are using it. But, yeah, I mean, don't you remember the wine press?
Yes, of course.
On Fleet Street.
Yeah.
That was kind of Coke Central. I used to watch them all disappearing off to the toilets,
yeah,
together to do a few lines. I never took it myself. I,
yeah,
will say that.
No, I never.
I'm too susceptible to a bottle of wine. You know, if,
yeah,
if I drink too much, the hangovers are terrible. So
yes,
I would be too scared to take something like that.
Yeah.
That I didn't actually know what would happen to me.
So would I.
And I also know two people who died from being cocaine addicts.
Well, I don't actually, you see, because I don't mix no circles. The one that always terrified me, and I always wondered whether somebody would slip it in my drink or something, was the possibility of taking LSD. Because, of course, when we were growing up, certainly when I was growing up and, you know, the Beatles and the Stones were at their peak, we were told that all rock stars take lysergic acid diethylamide, which, of course, is the LSD tablet. And then, yeah, you either get a good trip or a bad trip, you know. And I thought, I'm never going to take one of those because you can bet your life mine will be a bad trip. And used to read horrifying stories of people on LSD who used to go and find a knife and then start cutting their skin off because they thought they were an orange and they were peeling themselves.
Oh, I mean, God, that's,
you know,
horrible.
Yeah, you know, horrible sorts of stuff. Anyway.
Do you remember the drugs raid at Redlands, Keith Richards' house?
Yes, I do, yeah.
In Sussex. That was a party that was arranged to initiate Mick Jagger into his first acid trip.
Oh, really? I didn't know
that. Which is LSD. Yeah, yeah, that's what that was all about.
Blimey.
But it's these psychedelic drugs, as they called them, they're very dangerous things. Because,
yeah, it must be. But, I mean, I think the Beatles were on all those sort of drugs when they wrote,
yeah, they were,
Sgt. Pepper's, weren't they?
Yeah,
so, and,
yeah,
that's the only way,
yeah,
it became so colourful, really.
John Lennon tried to say that Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was based on a painting that his little,
yeah,
boy Julian did at school. But it wasn't. You just got to read the lyrics. You know, marmalade skies and all that. It's
yeah,
obviously about an acid trip.
Oh, yeah. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore waiting to take us away. Who is the girl with the tangerine eyes and all that kind of stuff? I agree.
Yeah.
The yeah, lyrics are very lysergic acid diethylamide, but his explanation...
he said very scientifically.
Yes, that's right. But his explanation... it's all backed up by evidence. There's a picture of the painting that he brought home. Julian brought it home, shown his father. There was an obituary to the little girl Lucy who died, and she, you know, was named as the subject of the story. And I genuinely believe that it was written about Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Julian's little friend at school. But the words, of course, were massively drug induced. I don't know how the two came together.
Do you know what I think? That John saw that painting, probably, or the little watercolour that was done,
yeah,
at school, and the lyrics were his interpretation. But, of course, his mind was out there,
yeah,
pushing the walls out,
yeah,
and he came up with very extreme interpretations.
Yeah,
that's
no,
what
I'm sure you're right. It's the Lennon mind at its finest, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
reaching,
yeah, yeah,
into areas where other people just can't go. No, I...
And we ought to maybe make mention of the fact that as we record today, it is the 41st anniversary of the murder of John Lennon.
My God, I'm glad you reminded me. I'd forgotten, of course. And this time last year, it was huge, wasn't it? Because it was the 40th anniversary. And of course, your book was celebrating, well, if that's the word, or commemorating
indeed,
both his birthday a few months before and then his death. Yeah, golly, how time
41
flies.
Years, isn't it scary?
It is absolutely scary, yeah, absolutely scary. Talking about people who might be on drugs, I wonder if Harry's now started taking drugs and he lives in California, because we don't want to talk about Harry and Meghan forever because you could never stop talking about them.
I'm so bored with those two. Yeah, really, I am.
I totally agree with you. But for Harry to just blithely wave his arm and say, oh, well, if people don't like their job, they should give it up. It's good for their mental health. I mean, what planet are you living on? Most people don't trouser 100 million from Netflix to start off with.
Exactly. So out of touch. It's not true. The rule of thumb when we were in Fleet Street was always never give up your job until you've got another one to go to.
Exactly, yeah. And then
how can you go, oh, I'm sorry, I've had enough of this. Okay, not going to do this anymore. For the vast majority of people, that is not realistic.
I totally agree. And then when we got a job in Fleet Street, you clung on to it so tight that everybody was trying to take your job off you. You had to cling on to it and fight your way out of corners and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And to say, oh, just blithely give it up. I mean, yeah, that's completely the attitude of Harry's life. Oh, if it's too tough, just don't do it. You know what I mean? And he's made 100 million out of selling his own family down the river. He's got the most gilded life imaginable. What a pathetic person to go around trying to offer advice to the 99.9% of us who literally have to get out of bed in the morning to pay the bills.
But what I think you know about this, I won't say I'm worried about it because I try not to think about it too much, but where are those two in 5 years? I can't see Meghan being satisfied with the lifestyle that she has at the moment. Yeah, there's all the money. There's a great house. There's Harry. There's two lovely children.
Yeah.
But she wants more than that. You know, we hear rumours about her bid for the presidency in America, this kind of thing.
You couldn't get it.
They seem to have put the kibosh on that for a couple of reasons.
Well, she's such an airhead. You couldn't possibly think of her as a politician. I mean,
well, not really.
She can't think straight.
In 5 years' time, is she going to be sick and tired of Harry? Does she then kick Harry out? She's going to stay in America because her children are American. Her mother's American.
Yeah.
She is there. So what, does Harry come back here with his tail between his legs and then he never gets to see his two lovely children?
Mm.
How does that pan out?
Yeah, I think she will boot him out, honestly.
That's what I think too.
I think Harry as a single man was interesting and he was lively and he was somebody to look up to because he had such a privileged position, but he tried to lead quite a normal life. He'd been a soldier and all that. But the Harry I see these days is an absolute dullard. You know, he doesn't have a smile. He's a dullard. He's got all these wacko beliefs in, you know, the way life should be run, all in my view infused into his soul by his wife, and it's just not him. I don't know what he's got to offer these days. Do you?
Not at all. No. The other important point is that the kids loved him.
Yes.
So my children, all their friends, you know, their generation had a royal to look up to. The royal family didn't mean anything to them otherwise.
Yeah, that's
and true. Then when Harry disappeared off the scene and got married to somebody controversial, left the royal family, dumped all his responsibilities to the armed forces, all of that, the kids are going, well, Harry's not cool. And so now they don't care about the royal family again.
Yeah.
So he had a very important role to play, which I don't think he even realised how much he meant to their generation.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right. Talking about people in the public eye, I'm just taking a bit of a U-turn here. I'm starting to quite like that Angela Rayner, you know, the deputy leader of the Labour Party.
Are you?
Yeah, I think she's very fanciable.
Oh, dear. God, you're scraping the barrel, Michael.
That's a bit harsh, Leslie. And you're talking about another woman here. That's not, you know, that's not very sisterhoodish, is it?
Well, I think she's a bit foul-mouthed in common, I've got to say.
Foul-mouthed in common. Oh, I fancy Miss Jones. Yeah. I quite like her because she's, you know, aggressive, sparky. I mean, her background is amazing. You know, she was a single mum at 16 and all that. She's now an MP. She's deputy leader of the Labour Party. And she's gutsy, if nothing else. And I quite like the way she talks as well. She's got a bit of a lift.
A bit of a lift. Now you're making fun of people who have lisp.
No, I'm not. I'm imitating the way she speaks. And when she says, you know, Tory scum, I think it's quite appealing.
But that's surely cultural appropriation. Will find fault with that.
Appropriation, I should imagine. Not that I'm calling Tory scum or otherwise. I'm completely apolitical on this one. But she's very feisty, and she gets into the public eye, and she's got lovely long hair as well. So
now we know what does it.
I think she's very noticeable, put it that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she is. But is she the right foil for Keir Starmer?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think she could ever be leader of the Labour Party. And when a couple of weeks ago it was the remembrance service, you know, on what's the Sunday called?
Remembrance Sunday.
Remembrance Sunday, funny enough. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very good. Well done. Funny enough, the remembrance service was on Remembrance Sunday. You're absolutely right. And she turned up with her, you know, wreath in a bright red coat, short skirt. Somebody described her shoes as stripper heels. I've never heard that.
Yeah, they call them pawn shoes, I think.
Pawn shoes, that's right, yeah. So I thought, that's not really the image this country wants to portray overseas and all that kind of stuff.
Not at all. You're supposed to wear black because it's a solemn occasion.
Exactly. But anyway, look, she's different, and I just thought I'd mention it. Now, talking about your home country, Wales, Miss Jones. I know we weren't, but we are going to now.
Cut to,
Absolutely. Do you know the Vale of Arran? And if you do, the Vale of Arran pub, because it's been reopened by some guy who's an actor, I think, called Matthew Rees, because it was apparently Dylan Thomas's favourite watering hole.
Well, it wasn't.
Ah.
Dylan Thomas, being an alcoholic, had a variety of pubs in different parts of the world that were all his favourite pub when he was in the vicinity.
Yes, that's true.
But actually, his kind of chief watering hole was a place called Brown's Hotel in Larne, where he lived and where he had his writing studio.
Oh, yeah.
But this particular pub, the Vale of Arran, is in a place called Ystrad Arran, which is in... They call it Ceredigion now, but we call it Cardigan. Yeah, there. We call it Cardigan.
Hello, boy.
Yeah, but it's up there. Anyway, but I think it's reopened as a community pub, but people can put money into it. So he is just one of the investors in the reopening of this pub. The question I have is Dylan Thomas really that relevant anymore?
Well, it's a good question. We did Dylan Thomas at school under Milk Wood, okay?
Yeah, I was in that as well. Yeah, I was Polly Garter.
Yeah, Polly Garter, that's right. The great line in that is about the girl who got kissed once when she wasn't looking but has never been kissed again, though she's been looking ever since. I remember that line.
You would remember that, yes.
Yeah, you would remember that line, indeed. But, you see, I could never quite understand at that age why Dylan Thomas was a great poet. To me, that wasn't a poem. Poems are things where, I mean, the Beatles wrote better poems than Dylan Thomas because the words rhymed with each other, you know what I mean?
I don't think poetry is just about rhyming. You know, there are different styles. But, of course, Under Milk Wood was a play for radio.
Right.
Rather than poetry, wasn't it?
But was it, yeah.
His great use of words and his imagery. You know, he used words that weren't normally used in that kind of writing.
Yeah.
And he evoked images that hitherto hadn't been experienced, let's say. But he was an alcoholic and he was a terrible degenerate. He didn't look after his children properly, spent all money that came his way on booze, drank himself to death, actually. I've been to his grave.
Yeah.
It is in Larne. And he had an awful relationship with his wife, Catelyn. And some of his kids have tried to sort of launch themselves as poets in his name. But that kind of thing never works, does it?
No.
It doesn't work for rock star kids.
No, it doesn't. No.
It doesn't work for poets' kids either.
That's amazing because you stand back and you kind of admire, you know, there's something in me which says, what a great way to have come, lived life and gone. You know, Dylan Thomas, alcoholic, drank himself to death, I think, after 46 large whiskies, many of which were consumed in the bar of the Chelsea Hotel in New York, if I'm if I remember rightly. Is that right?
Yeah. Was, you know, he was a rock star poet, wasn't he?
He was, yeah.
He was one of those who sort of swanned around and had the flowing hair and the disheveled clothes and spoke in a booming voice. And I think it was all about the idea of Dylan Thomas rather than the actual quite shabby individual, really.
Yeah, I agree. And also the name. A name often makes people, you know, if you're called Joe DiMaggio or Dylan Thomas, it's a very memorable sort of name, you know what I mean? But
something a bit Oscar Wilde-ish about
him. Yes, that's right, yeah.
Something fan de siècle, something, you know, really to look down upon and pity.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Now, who's John Miles? Because John Miles has died, sadly. He's a musician. I can only remember one song he ever made. And what was it called? I've forgotten. Music.
Yeah, but the title of the song was just Music.
Right. And
we paid tribute to him yesterday at the lunch.
Actually. Oh, right. Okay.
Great musician. Many of the guys in the room there worked with him yesterday.
Really? Yeah.
He'd been around for a long time. He was in a lot of Geordie bands in his early days.
Oh, yeah.
He signed to Decca, the label that famously turned down the Beatles, and had four big albums through the 70s.
Yeah.
Music was obviously his biggest hit, but he had a top 20 with High Fly. There was another song called Remember Yesterday. Slow Down is another one. Somebody played it on the radio yesterday. Yeah. Ken Bruce. Yeah. Ken Bruce played it on the radio yesterday. Mm-hmm. That was his biggest US chart hit. And his solo career sort of dried up after that.
Yeah.
But he didn't stop working. He used to perform every year in this thing called the Night of the Proms, which was staged across Europe and America every year. Mm-hmm. He toured with Tina Turner.
Yeah.
For years and years, since 1987, played keyboards for her and did backing vocals. Mm. And he also worked with Jimmy Page and the Alan Parsons Project.
Oh, really?
And he was working in musical theatre. Within the industry, he was a big name. Mm. He just, you know, he faded from the charts, but that doesn't mean to say that his career was axed.
Music is my first love, and it will be my last. Music for the future, music for the past. That wasn't bad, was it?
Not bad at all. I tell you who sang it for us yesterday and played keyboards was your friend Mike Batt.
Oh, really? Oh, blimey, that's amazing. Mike Batt of Womble's fame and Bright Eyes fame. Oh, lovely man, Mike Batt. I told you I met him on the set of a show I was doing a few months ago. A lovely guy to talk to, really.
He really is. He also performed for us his song that David Essex had a hit with, that Mike Batt wrote.
I'm going to make you a star.
Not that one. Which one? It's a Christmas song called A Winter's Tale.
Oh, right. Is that like... well, it's like A Winter's Tale, if you see what I mean. It's like a poem put to music, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, the Winter's Tale was obviously famously a Shakespeare play.
But, yes.
He and Tim Rice wrote this song, Only a Winter's Tale. I can't sing it, but you will know the song. Look it up.
Yeah.
And Mike performed it yesterday. And Bruce Welsh from The Shadows absolutely loved that song. And he stood up at the back while this was being performed. And he sang every word with a big beaming smile on his face. People were taking pictures of Bruce enjoying the song because it was wonderful to hear the composer of it singing it live.
Well, this was at your lunch. This all at your lunch. Bruce Welsh must be a fine age. He's a member of the Shadows, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And Brian Bennett, who's the drummer of the Shadows,
usually
comes as well, but he was unwell yesterday.
Yeah, oh, right. Okay. I told you, didn't I? I had an experience once with that member of the Shadows who, you know, he was the sort of bad boy of the band. I've forgotten his name now, but he got
Hank Marvin.
No, not Hank. No, Hank was Hank was the good boy of the band. I can't remember who it was now, but I saw him in concert in some small town in the Midlands or something. He was pissed all the time and fell off the stage, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Oh.
But I can't remember who he is.
No, I can't either.
Anyway.
It's a bit before my time, The Shadows, but
yeah.
I mean, they're great guys and they've got such stories as well.
Incredible. Yes, indeed. They're the only group that could get away with making songs without words. They made one called Foot Tapper.
I think they're called instrumentals, not songs without words.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they're songs without words. It can't be the point of making a song if you don't sing. Anyway, there you go.
Well, that's like no different from a soundtrack from a movie, is it, really?
Well, but at least a soundtrack from a movie has an image behind it, doesn't it? You know, if it's da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da, then you know it's a good, the bad, the ugly. Whereas Foot Tapper doesn't really give you an image of anything. But anyway, there we are. Okay, folks, you're listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed. Hurtling towards Christmas, of course, Miss Jones. I have to say, again, you know, what a great response we get from the audience. And I've already had lots of good wishes from people saying, you know, have a great Christmas. Are you going to be around in the new year? All that kind of stuff, you know. So once again, I want to extend a big thanks to all our listeners.
Our listeners are wonderful. And, you know, we've got people listening to this podcast down in Australia, as we were reminded this week.
Yes.
John and Adrian Wells, who they wrote us a note, didn't they? They nearly drove their car off the road listening to the last podcast.
Yes.
I think we maybe went a bit over the top last week.
Well, they probably listened to some nonsense you were talking, Miss Jones, because, of course, I'm the, you know, the seeker of truth and justice.
You're the sensible one. Yeah,
that's right. The voice of reason. So that's probably the answer to that one. No, it's nice to think, isn't it, that, you know, we record in our studios at home here in England and somebody on the other side of the world is driving in their car in Australia and listening to it. Talking about Australia, by the way, fingers crossed as we're recording this now, as I'm here with you, Miss Jones, because my nephew is due to fly today to Australia with his girlfriend, who's Australian. They haven't been there for 2.5 years. She hasn't seen her parents for 2.5 years because of lockdowns and all that. And they've been in self-isolation for the last 10 days, right? They had to. That's part of the rules of flying. They had to be in a Heathrow hotel overnight last night. Flight goes this morning. But, you know, they are so nervous at the last minute something could happen, particularly with the Omicron. What's it called? Omicron. Yeah, Omicron. You know, they were nervous. I think they'll have got away by now. I'm going to double check that and ring my sister after we finish this podcast. But they were so nervous at the last moment, the government could just introduce a new rule. You know what I mean?
And what happens if that does happen? Do they lose all the money?
I have no idea. I think each case is so individual, you'd have to work it out, whether you'd get it back on insurance, whether you lose it. You know, just paying for the hotel alone adds huge costs onto your trip.
Yeah, it does.
And when they get to the other end, when they get to Australia, they're staying for 3 months because there's little point in going just, you know, for Christmas and coming back because of the amount of hassle, all the travel restrictions, the cost of locking yourself up in hotels and all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Well, I hope that they have a safe journey, and I hope they have a fantastic Christmas and New Year down there.
Yeah, so
and I hope they get back in one piece.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Now, talking about travel and abroad and all that, I was quite dismayed to see the fact that Barbados is now no longer wants the Queen as the head of state. It's not left the Commonwealth, still in the Commonwealth, but it's decided to become a republic. And I love Barbados. I've been there loads of times. Used to go down there for the weekend when we lived in New York. And the stories I've done down there, chased Mick Jagger around, chased Diana, Prince of Wales, around on yachts around the Caribbean islands. Have you done a lot of Barbados, Miss Jones?
I nipped into Barbados once on a story. But, you know, this becoming a republic thing is very worrying, isn't it? Because then we read about all the Chinese investment into Barbados. And China seems to be snapping up our former colonies and investing in them heavily so that it will be the Chinese empire in the world pretty soon instead of the British empire.
Well, you're absolutely right, but it's not just British territories that the Chinese are snapping up. They're snapping them up all over the place. I mean, for instance, in Africa, what the Chinese are doing, and this is not because I'm a financial genius, I read about it in a Sunday newspaper, they go to these countries, lend them huge amounts of money to rebuild their countries, and then they, when they want the money back, they can't repay it, and so the Chinese have to take influence in the country. So, like I'm told, in Sri Lanka, they lent the government hundreds of millions of pounds to build a new dock, you know, a new sort of harbour. And, of course, Sri Lanka got no chance of paying that back. So the Chinese, you know, to all intents and purposes, now own that that harbour, that dockside, and they can send their ships there anytime they want. I mean, you're absolutely right. China are building a worldwide empire.
It's very sinister. You know, we've got this going on in Russia and Ukraine at the moment. What is that? You know, what, are we going to start a war over some territory that nobody seems to know who it belongs to? What is the world coming to?
Well, to be honest, you can ask that question, but ever since time immemorial, men and women have fought over land, haven't they? That's, you know, that's been the one constant. That's what wars start over land. That's why the Second World War happened. It's why the First World War happened. It's why the Hundred Years' Wars happened, you know, and I'm afraid that is. But just getting a bit brighter about Barbados, I've told the story before about tracking Mick Jagger down there. Jagger had fled to Barbados when Jerry Hall, I think, had run off with the racehorse owner, Robert Sangster. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah, she got fed up to the back teeth of Mick Jagger and his various dalliances.
All his shagging, yeah.
Well, yeah, to put it mildly. Family show, Miss Jones, you know. Can we say relationships, please? And
they weren't relationships. They were one-night stands.
Well, that's still a relationship, isn't it? But no, even if it's a
it's
short...
It's not. No, it
yeah,
isn't.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so... I am more diligent than most people who work in our profession, yourself excluded, and we all got to Barbados. And I was quite early into my career as a New York correspondent with the Daily Express. I couldn't quite work out why all the guys were like out water skiing or lying on the beach or getting pissed in, the bars down the road. And so naively, I said, "Don't think we'd better go and look for Mick Jagger." And I didn't realise they worked as such a tight pack that they would all go off and look for him together, you know what I mean? And therefore, there was no danger of somebody finding Jagger while the others were out water skiing or in the bar. And there was an agreement, if anybody stumbled across Jagger, they would share it with everybody else. But I didn't want to do that, you know. So I said, oh, okay. I said, I've just got to make a phone call, ring my office. And I slipped out the hotel, hired a mini moke, and grabbed, you know, my photographer, and off we went. We found him first. So that made me very unpopular.
I'm sure it did, because, you know, there were those agreements, weren't there?
Yes.
In those days, we ran as a pack and you shared the stories. You could get fired for that, of course. I was challenged about that by a showbiz editor once.
Yeah.
Peter, somebody, can't remember his other name now. And he said to me, are you sharing stories with so-and-so from the Daily Mirror?
Yeah.
And I had to deny it because I would have got fired on the spot.
Yeah, but were you?
Yeah.
On what sort of agreement? That she would also help you out with stories?
It was, I tell you where we were, it was the Montreux Rock Festival.
Oh, yes.
Down in Switzerland. Mm. And we were all running around. There were so many rock stars down there. And you couldn't keep your eye on every single one the time.
Exactly.
So we shared them out. You do Michael Hutchins.
Yeah.
You know, you do Paul McCartney. You do Boy George. And it was like that. And we would share the spoils.
Yes.
But of course, this was against the rules, wasn't it? Back in the office.
Yes.
So we could get sacked for that.
Yeah, you could.
So we had to say that we weren't doing it, which is unfortunate. But we were doing it. Yeah.
No.
So you hired a mini moke and you found Mick Jagger where?
In a villa inland. So we were, funny enough, we were at the famous hotel, the Sandy Lanes, okay? But the Sandy Lanes in those days was just a good hotel. These days, it's one of the world's top hotels, you see what I mean? Because Barbados has developed over the decades. And I just asked around, where do all the people stay when they come in? They rent villas and all that. And we were driving up and down roads, knocking on villa doors, knocked on the door of a villa at the top of a hill. And, you know, I used the usual old load of bollocks about, you know, oh, hi, you know, my name's Arthur. I'm from the record company in London. Where's Mick? You know, I have to talk to him. And, you know, tried that about a dozen times. And on the on the 12th occasion, the woman who opened the door, because all the houses had staff and maids and that, I said, oh, hi. I said, Mike Parry here. I'm from the record company in London. I need to talk to Mick right now. I've got a contract I've got to talk to him about. Where is he, please? She said, oh, I'm awfully sorry. This is not Mick's villa. This is Keith Richards' villa. But Keith isn't here. I said, oh, is Mick staying here? She said, no. And she pointed down the hill. She said, no, Mick's staying in that villa down at the bottom of the hill. I saw him arrive yesterday. I said, oh, that's, thank you very much indeed. You know, and so we got back in the minimoke, drove down the hill. And as we were driving down the hill, we could work out people lying around the swimming pool. And then somebody alerted the people around the swimming pool the fact there was a mini moke hurtling down the hill. And the person got up and it was Mick Jagger and he ran into the house. And it took an hour or two of negotiation through the letterbox, literally, to get him to come out. And then I had to I had to go back to the hotel because communications were not like they are today. There were no mobile phones or anything. And I had to get Larry Lamb, the editor of The Express then, another arch drunk, by the way, God rest his but
yeah.
No, but he was. But he was a well-known Fleet Street drunk. Rest in peace, Larry, and all that kind of stuff.
Rest in pieces.
Yeah, rest in pieces. That's right. I had to get a telex, as it was in those days, from Larry Lamb, saying that if Mick Jagger agreed to talk to me for 30 minutes, I would agree not to disclose his location to any other newspaper people, and I would not bother him again while he was in Barbados. I got that, took it back, Mick talked to me, and bingo, we had the story. But it made me very unpopular with all the other guys.
I'm sure it did. But what did he say? Was it the 30 minutes, was that worthwhile? Did you get anything exclusive?
Well, yes. I can't remember what it was now, but it was much more than 30 minutes. Once he'd relaxed and invited me in to sit around the pool and drink gin and tonic, it was great. You know, he was fine. It was just a kind of, you know, of course I want to make it up to Jerry and all this, and, you know, oh, you know, she doesn't understand me and all this. It was all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But
a load of old bollocks then.
Yeah, a load of old bollocks. But if you get to talk to Mick Jagger and you get it on the, you know, a story on the front page turning inside to 4 and 5, it's a big success, isn't it?
Of course. And well done you, because that is a colour piece, isn't it, really? What we call a colour piece.
Yes.
So you describe the swimming pool. You describe the piece of lemon in your gin and tonic.
Yes, that's right.
And you describe Mick's saggy lips and his his little boxer shorts hanging around his tiny bum and all that. And the quotes are inconsequential, really, aren't they?
Yes, they are completely. I totally agree. And, of course, I was lucky enough to have a photographer with me, so there were great pictures of Mick sitting on the end of his diving board over his swimming pool, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So
you would never get that now. No journalist would get that now. So
really?
You did very well. Yeah.
Yeah,
they would never agree to something like that these days.
Yeah. Well, I just told him I wasn't going away until he talked to me, basically, you know, and it wasn't a threat. It was a deal. Lots of photographers do that sort of deal these days, you know, particularly down in Cornwall. They'll just say, look, I know you're going to be on the beach later. I want to take some snap for 30 seconds. I'll leave you alone. So I think that's quite sensible, really.
Yeah, it is. But they've all been tormented by paparazzi for so many decades now, haven't they?
Yeah.
Did you see that the Stones did an impromptu gig at Ronnie Scott's this week?
No, I didn't. I didn't, no.
Yeah. Yeah, they did a little tribute to Charlie Watts, which was arranged by his wife and family.
Right.
And Jules Holland compared the event they had. It was mainly kind of jazz, Charlie's music, you know, Charlie's kind of musicians.
Yeah.
And then at the end, the other Stones got up on stage and did a little tribute to him.
Oh, golly, that's really nice, isn't it?
But you see, most people won't have any idea that the Stones are even in London.
No, I didn't. I if you'd have asked me where are the Stones, I said, well, they're still in America, aren't they, doing their world tour?
Yeah. Yeah, they finished now.
Mm, yeah, amazing. Oh, well, that'd be
interesting, isn't it? That they can sneak into Soho and get into Ronnie Scott's, and there are no pictures of them on the streets at all.
Yeah.
So they managed to smuggle themselves everywhere.
Yeah, I suppose these days you have to agree to hand in your phone when you go to things like that, don't you, so you don't take pictures?
I guess so. I was at a gig. It was, what was it? Barbara Streisand at the O2 a few years ago.
Yeah.
And we did actually have to hand in our mobiles
for
that show.
Right.
But how can you police that? How can you identify every single person's mobile and get them all right back to the right person?
Anyway, wouldn't the clever person have a spare mobile in their sock? So that, you know, they could have two, you know.
Yeah, but the minute you whip it out and take a picture, you're out.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, beaten up and get your camera taken off you. You're absolutely right. Talking about islands, by the way, the severe weather we've been suffering lately has been awful. I mean, not so much for us down in the southeast, but certainly in the north. I mean, people up there, no electricity for 10 days because the pylons were torn down, you know, by 90-mile-an-hour winds and all that kind of stuff. But what I did see, we were talking about Barbados, was the way that the Isle of Man got flooded, okay? And that's another favourite island of mine, the Isle of Man, because I have such fond memories. Years and years ago, when I was a callow youth, a reporter on the Chester Chronicle, the pubs used to shut at 2:30 in the afternoon and not open again until 5:30 in the evening. So that was the only work you did in the afternoons. You stayed in the pub until 2:30, went back and did 3 hours work on Chester Chronicle in time to get back for reopening at 5:30. It was a good way to work your day, to be honest. You worked very intensely for 3 hours and had to get it all out the way so you didn't miss a minute of drinking time, you know, in the evening.
But, it's amazing you're still alive, I think.
Well, I think you're right, it is. But we discovered that in the Isle of Man, on May the 15th every year, because they had a separate jurisdiction for drinking laws, their pubs opened all day for the summer season, from May the 15th to September the 15th or something like that, you know. So we thought, this is brilliant. So we used to get a ferry from Liverpool at 6 a.m. on the Saturday morning. Ferry took about 4 or 5 hours to get to the Isle of Man. So you used to get there for an opening time, which was 11 o'clock, okay? But in fact, they were already open because the bar on the ferry was open for the minute it sailed from Liverpool, and it was on the high seas, right? So we could start drinking at 6:30. We got to, the Peveril in, which port would that be? Ramsey or somewhere like that, you know. And the Peveril was the first pub outside the dock gates. And we'd go in there at 11 o'clock. And then we used to go right down the front of the town. Again, I think it was Ramsey. Did I say that? Ramsey, yeah.
You did, yes.
Yeah. And drink in every pub until the ferry left at 1 o'clock in the morning. And we'd get back.
How come you were not in hospital by this time?
I don't know. We were young and you know, fit and durable. And
you can really drink booze at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Well, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, when you know I was still working at Pasty, where I was travelling abroad, I would love getting to Gatwick for an early flight, say 8:30 or 9 o'clock, because I'd get to Gatwick at 6 o'clock because Wetherspoons was open at 6 a.m. at Gatwick, and it's one of the biggest pubs in the world. And I always found that a great thrill to have a couple of pints of beer with my sausage butty breakfast, you know.
Oh, great. God, how are you not dead?
I don't know. Many people would say, why are you not dead?
Yes.
But anyway.
Not the one saying that, by the way.
No. To finish this long and rambling story, we get back on the ferry.
Yeah, get on with it.
1 o'clock in the morning. And then the ferry bar was open all the way back to Liverpool when we docked at 6 o'clock. So it was a solid 24 hours of drinking on water and on land and then back on water without any sleep.
And, oh, horrible. I would have been so ill.
Well, I think, you know, I was young and durable enough. But I remember I nearly got arrested on the boat back because I was found in a compromising position in the sail room. With a young
Who
lady.
Is? Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's just typical, isn't it? Well, it always has to end up with a girl with her drawers around her ankle.
Excuse me, Miss Jones.
Well, you're the one doing it. I'm not
having that sort of image portrayed on my behalf. No, I'm sorry, I'm not. This is not like, you know, this is live on Planet Porky, not on Planet Pornography. I'm not having it, Miss Jones, okay? Right. But anyway, they were fun days. And the reason I'm saying this is because I saw the images of the Isle of Man completely flooded, Ramsey seafront flooded and all that kind of stuff. And it took me back to those halcyon days. Listen, I want to, we can't leave the podcast without talking Beatles, because we always do.
We just did. But anyway, do it again.
I had a meeting in London this week, okay? And it was a lovely sort of pub stroke restaurant around the Waterloo area. And it wasn't that packed. We met at 12:30, got a nice table and all that. And me and the guy I was with are both Beatles aficionados, okay? And we were talking Beatles. All of a sudden, a young barman comes over. Well, I say young. I think he was under 30. You know, he was probably about 27, 28, something like that. And said, oh, hello. He said, I couldn't help overhearing what you were talking about. You know, we've been talking about some particular story about the Beatles or something like that. And he said, would you like me to put some Beatles music on for you? Because they had, like, you know, pipe music. And we said, oh, yeah, if you've got something. You know, he then put on the White Album, right? And we called him over and we said, this is very good of you. You know, I know you have this sort of music. He said, I've got all the Beatles music. He said, I'm a huge Beatles fan. He said, I'm a student of the Beatles, and that's why I was so interested in what you were saying. And he said, you know, how old are you? And I think he said 27. I said, I didn't even know that 27-year-olds, you know, took up listening to the Beatles. He said, oh, yes. He said, millions, he said, of people of my generation have rediscovered the Beatles. He said, and it's, you know, it's going to last forever. It's like Mozart. The Beatles will never go away. And I thought that was an amazing thing to hear from a chap of his age.
Well, it's so true as well, isn't it? I mean, in such a short space of time,
yeah.
8 years, 12 albums, the journey from Love Me Do to Strawberry Fields
yes.
was just incredible. No other band has ever done it. No other band will ever do it, I don't think.
Exactly.
So their influence is so far reaching. And I hear all the time people saying, oh, I hate the Beatles. Oh, the Beatles are so boring. Mm. And you think, well, you've just got no idea.
No, exactly.
How so many artists who've come since, probably all of them, have been influenced by those four boys from Liverpool.
Exactly. You know, the very basic single you've just talked about, love, love me do, you know I love you, I'll always be true, so please love me do. They went from that, I'm sorry, they went from that to producing what many believe the greatest ever LP, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, in 4.5 years.
Exactly.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
And so much of it, of course, was down to their producer, George Martin, and his talent, his musicality, and his imagination as well, you'd have to say.
That's right. You know, that the track that starts the second half of Sgt. Pepper's, For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, I mean, he used like a steam organ in that. Do you remember? I thought I'd just, I'm like a human.
Yeah, as you were.
I'm like a human synthesizer, aren't I?
You're one of those one-man band.
One-man band, that's right, yeah. Listen, just before we go, and thanks to everybody for listening today, I have to mention Kate Garraway again. I have so much respect for that woman, and she did the Piers Morgan, what's it called, Secret Lives or something? No,
Life Stories.
Life Stories, well done. And talked again about her husband, Derek. That woman has now been consigned to the same sort of hellish existence that her husband is consigned to, because he lives in a hospital bed in a house. And when he speaks three words, which so lovingly were, I love you, it's a brilliant day for her, but she's living with it 24 hours a day, day in, day out. I have so much respect for Kate Garraway. My heart bleeds for her. I you know, she won't want people to feel sorry for her, but my God, have you ever met a more stoic woman in your life?
It's just awful what they've been through as a family. Mm. And, it, you know, the way it's impacted on their children as well is just awful. But I hope he makes a recovery one of these days. It doesn't look likely, but, you know, miracles do happen.
Yeah.
So I hope it happens for them, because they've been through so much.
They have. I totally agree. Anyway, there we are. Righto, Miss Jones. So, look, we're all busy. Christmas is looming. Things have got to be done. Are you going to have a turkey this year?
We're going to some friends who are cooking turkey, yes.
Oh, so, lovely. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have, you know, the usual bum fight. It'll be good.
Yeah.
How about you?
Well, I'm not going to have a turkey this year. And I'll tell you why. Because we were all locked down last year, I didn't go to the family. I'm very happy to do it on my own, you know, at my home in Surrey. Not a problem at all. But I bought this massive turkey crown, it's called, okay? And, I mean, it's huge.
Don't tell me you've still got it in the freezer.
I haven't still got it, but I had it for about 10 days afterwards, you know what I mean? And I now can't eat turkey, really.
You've gone off it? Yeah, so what will you have, a goose or something?
No, chicken. I'm going to Bournemouth this year. We've all decided chicken would be lovely. We all had the same turkey problem last year.
So interesting.
Chicken on Christmas Day and beef Wellington on Boxing Day.
Very nice to you.
Indeed. Right. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for having tuned in. Miss Jones, as I say, have a good couple of days, and we will be back with our audience this time next week. We were told that all rock stars take lysergic acid diethylamide, which, of course, is the LSD tablet, and then you either get a good trip or a bad trip, you know? And I thought, I'm never going to take one of those, because you can bet your life mine will be a bad trip. And used to read horrifying stories of people on LSD who used to go and find a knife and then start cutting their skin off because they thought they were an orange and they were peeling themselves.
Oh, I mean, God.
We get back on the ferry.
Yeah, get on with it.
1 o'clock in the morning. And then the ferry bar was open all the way back to Liverpool when we docked at 6 o'clock. So it was a solid 24 hours of drinking on water and on land and then back on water without any sleep. And,
Horrible. I would have been so ill.
Well, I think, you know, I was young and durable now. But I remember I nearly got arrested on the boat back because I was found in a compromising position in the sail room with a young lady.
Oh, no. It's just typical, isn't it? Well, it always has to end up with a girl with her drawers around her ankle.
Excuse me, Miss Jones.
Well, you're the one doing it.
I'm not having that sort of image portrayed on my behalf. No, I'm sorry, I'm not. This is not like, you know, this is live on Planet Porky, not on Planet Pornography. I'm not having it, Miss Jones, okay? When a couple of weeks ago it was the remembrance service, you know, on what's the Sunday called?
Remembrance Sunday.
Remembrance Sunday, funny enough. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very good. Well done.